I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour in a piece that she wrote that caught our attention, titled "We Are Entering a New Era of Migration and Not Just for People." She says when we look at the history of life on Earth, we see a repeated pattern in the response of living things to environmental change. Plants and animals alike have a remarkable capacity to migrate in response to changing conditions. And over many generations and thousands of years, this leads to wholesale changes in the geographic distribution of species and the composition of the world's ecosystems. Joining us this hour is Jessica Hellman. She is director of the Institute on the Indians. And over many generations and thousands of years, this leads to wholesale changes in the geographic distribution of species and the composition of the world's ecosystems. Joining us this hour is Jessica Hellman. She is director of the Institute on the Environment at the University of Minnesota. She provides leadership for the Institute, which is an internationally recognized organization working to solve grand environmental challenges. She's also the Russell and Elizabeth Bennett Chair in Excellence in the Department of Ecology, Evolution, and Behavior in the College of Biological Sciences, and her research focuses on global change, ecology, and climate adaptation. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Jessica. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's @KDunnShow. Professor Jessica Hellman, thank you very much for being with us. Good afternoon.
Hi, it's a pleasure to talk with you, Kathleen.
Yeah, it should be really interesting. So let's look at this history that you remind us of, that when we look at history of life on Earth, we do see a pattern in our response to environmental change. What do you see?
Well, we know when we look in the fossil record, we see things that are buried in the ground, and we look at where organisms lived in the past, and we know we've experienced climate changes in the past. You know, the Earth goes through ice ages repeatedly, and we say, okay, well, where did things live during the last ice age, and where did they move as the ice sheet receded? And we know, for example, in North America, in Minnesota, Wisconsin, we were sitting under a huge block of ice, and all of the plants and animals that we associate with home were pushed down to the south, and as the ice sheet receded, those species moved further to the north. And that's the way life goes. It changes and adjusts and shifts geographically often when the climate changes. Mm-hmm. It can do other things, too. It can evolve. It can go extinct. But that's the dominant signal we see in the fossil record, is one of movement.
And in the article, you suggest that the situation today is different than the fossil record, in that the rate of change is at least going to be 10 times the rate observed at the end of the last ice age? 10 times?
Yeah, there are a series of studies comparing the signals that we have seen of past climate change, and we ask, how much did the climate change in the past, and how quickly did it change in the past? And we compare that, climate scientists compare that to what we expect to see of the rate of magnitude and the rate of change under what we call modern climate change or human-caused climate change. And so there were a series of studies published, well, last of which was in 2013, for example, that suggested that the rate of change, the magnitude of change, is we haven't seen for millions of years, and how quickly it changes is also 10 times faster than what we've seen in the recent past. And then as conservation, or as people working on living systems, we also know that the habitat, or the way the landscape looks, is very different than during the last ice age. And we've chopped things up and created barriers to dispersal. During the last ice age, we didn't have cities and we didn't have farms, for example, that living things had to migrate through as well. So now we think about the climate changing quickly, and we think about the landscape being divided up and chopped into pieces in a way that it wasn't in the past.
Mm-hmm. How many species will be affected? Do we know?
We have no idea. This is actually a fascinating and very important question and a source of controversy among ecologists. You know, it's a hard question to answer because I tell undergraduate students this often. We don't even know how many things live on Earth.
Oh.
We have no idea how many species there are on Earth. We can send people to the moon. We can do extraordinary things, but we have not yet counted how many species live with us here on Earth. That said, we have some estimates of how many species there are, and there have been some studies trying to estimate what fraction of the species living on Earth could be threatened with extinction from climate change. And a high-end estimate has been something was suggested being about a third of species on Earth. And I can tell you how we come up with that number, might be threatened with extinction. More recent numbers are probably a little lower. We did surveyed some experts, ecologists, published scientists on this topic. They say maybe 10, 15, 20% of species on Earth, but that's still millions and millions of species.
What about human beings?
Well, we were in the article you referenced. We were inspired. My colleague David Ackerley at the University of California, Berkeley, and I wrote this article. It was published in a collection of essays called The Conversation. We were inspired to write it because of the extraordinary crisis that Europe is facing of human migration, right? People moving from areas where they're suffering political unrest and in some cases environmental natural resource shortage and drought and food shortage as well. And that people flow, and David and I were talking and we said, you know, people flowing, if you asked a bunch of ecologists what would organisms do when the environment changes or when they face stressful conditions, biology would tell you that living things move. And of course, people are much more complicated and we have sophisticated structures that make us different than other organisms. But fundamentally, we are organisms too, and we depend on living things and are affected by food shortages and the climate like other creatures are too. And so we wrote this article to point out that if you think like an ecologist, you should imagine people are going to move just like other organisms move.
Can you remind us what happened to California? Give us an idea of what California used to look like, for that matter, what the poles used to look like.
Yeah, you can do this. If you look, in the case for the poles, if you look millions of years into the past, you can find times. You know, our planet has gone through extraordinary climate changes having to do with major changes in the Earth's orbit or fluctuations in the Earth's orbit and just the maturation of the planet as we know it. So there have been times in the past when the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere, for example, is similar to what humans have caused now. And there we had much less ice on our planet, and therefore things lived far, far to the north, for example, far much closer to the poles because it was much warmer up there. So when we think about what nature is like, each of us can imagine where we grew up or the kinds of plants and animals that are outside our window and our doors. We think of that as a constant, but it's not a constant. Organisms are very much influenced by their environment and by climate. And when the climate changes, they'll move and they'll change. So we should be prepared for some pretty profound adjustments to the things that are outside our window.
Mm. So we need to do more than just eliminate or try to greatly reduce carbon emissions.
Well, this is an interesting. We often say, we call that mitigation. So mitigation is stopping the very nature of the climate problem. So slow and then stop emitting greenhouse gases to the atmosphere. And those greenhouse gases get there through a variety of human processes, burning fossil fuels in our electricity generation and in transportation, for example, also through agriculture releases greenhouse gases and deforestation as well. So slowing and stopping that process is what we call mitigation. But we also are confronted with climate change already. It is happening to human populations, to natural populations, to other organisms already. We can see the signals of that in climate extremes. And it's really interesting thinking of all the world leaders headed to Paris. Are we going to be able to negotiate a deal to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the future? It seems like we will, but it's going to be a slow process. So we're going to continue to actually grow for at least another 10 or 15 years before the world begins to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions. And that's going to make the climate continue to change. So while we have to address the fundamental problem, we also need to be able to live with this new world we have created for ourselves. That's what we call adaptation. I like to talk about how these are two sides of the same.
Mm-hmm. And what kinds of adaptations have we made now, Professor Hellman?
Well, you're starting to see adaptation often in human populations, concerns about, for example, after we saw Hurricane Sandy come through, changes in settlement pattern, changes in how we do development around the world, reinventing what it means to do agriculture, for example, in places where there's marginal, where conditions are marginal for growing food, or we anticipate large changes in precipitation or temperature. We need to make adjustments ourselves. That's part of adaptation. Ecologists are thinking about adaptation from a natural resource management point of view, too. Where do we grow trees for timber? Where do our species, our endangered species live, or the species that play important roles in ecosystems and the way they cycle and function? So we think about how we're going to plan for those adjustments. And particularly, we worry about species that will have difficulty adjusting on their own, what things we can do to promote either natural adjustment or maybe even when we need to step in and do something much more aggressive to try to help living things adjust to changing conditions.
Mm-hmm. I worry that we're not on top of the game here.
Yes. On both sides, right? Mitigation and
right.
adaptation are two sides of the same coin. So I often say, here's one way where I worry we're not on top of the game. If we think that we might make adjustments to living in natural systems to reduce the effects of climate change, this is a hopeful thing. This is very important, and there are some concrete things that we can do. But if we don't get mitigation under control, if we don't slow and then stop the emissions of greenhouse gases, we're going to have very, very large climate change that we'll be confronting. And imagining adapting to that magnitude of change is just hard. Mm-hmm. It's hard to imagine. Now, so I often say it might be feasible to adapt to a lesser amount of climate change. Right now in the Paris negotiations, they're very much focused on preventing a 2 degrees C warming. So trying to keep the global average temperature of Earth under this tipping point, which we imagine is an important tipping point, or the model suggests might be a tipping point, keeping it below 2 degrees C warmer than the historic temperature. And that, if we were able to do that, then many of our adaptation strategies might be successful. The more change we have, the more adaptation we're going to need, and that's going to be more expensive. It's going to push us to the limits of our knowledge and our technological innovation, and we'll probably fall down on the job. And unfortunately, many people will suffer if that's the case, if we cannot adapt quickly enough to large amounts of change. And many of the creatures that we live with on this earth could be diminished or potentially eliminated.
Yeah. Are we already seeing, we've heard one of the consequences of climate change would be massive movements of people who are living on low-level land, particularly islands in various parts of the world, and they're just going to lose their land space. Are we seeing any migrations of those populations?
The main thing you see now with sea level rise is concern about storm surge.
Mm.
So as sea levels come up and as we have greater storm activity, because when a warmer climate is a more active climate, is one way to think of it. We're evaporating, a warmer climate evaporates more water, it makes it more stormy. We've talked about hurricanes, for example. There's some evidence to suggest that hurricanes might be stronger also under a warmer climate. And that's the initial concern, is that how the sea influences human communities that live near the water when storms and extreme events happen. As that water level continues to rise, that will become a bigger threat over time. There are also concerns about saltwater intrusion. As the water levels come up, it can pollute essentially our drinking water supplies, which will make it harder for people to live near to the coast. And so we look to low-lying areas as sort of our first canaries in the coal mine.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Professor Hellman. We're looking at adaptation and mitigation when it comes to change in climate. Our guest has written an interesting piece looking at the fossil records that show wave after wave of species migration and says that as dramatic as past episodes of climate change have been, they've generally played out over very long time periods, and she can go into more detail about how they played out. So the average rates of migration were fairly low. But today the situation is quite different, and the rate of change is projected to be at least 10 times the rate observed at the end of the last ice age. So what does that mean? It means a lot. And any questions that you have or comments about what she's already said, we'd love to hear from you. Jessica Hellman is the director of the Institute on the Environment at the University of Minnesota. She is also a chair in excellence in the Department of Ecology, Evolution, and Behavior in the College of Biological Sciences. Her research focuses on global change ecology, and she led a paradigm shift in ecology and natural resource management by showing that adaptation, living with climate change, is as crucial to the future of humanity and Earth's ecosystems as slowing and stopping greenhouse gas emissions. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. We'll be with you in just one moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls. We have many coming in for our guest, and she is Professor Jessica Hellman, and we start with Jake in Wauwatosa. Hello, Jake.
Good afternoon, Kathleen. Professor, it sure does sound like Green Bay, Milwaukee, Chicago, Gary, Cleveland, Buffalo, and Detroit are going to be key players in where people are going to be living with global warming because of our potable water with the Great Lakes system.
Yeah, that's a really interesting possibility, isn't it, to think about what the future of the Rust Belt might be. Could climate change in some ways provide new opportunity? We talk about this frequently, also for living things. Climate change is an adjustment from how things were in the past, which for many organisms is kind of like a shock or a perturbation. But there will be, for certain, winners and losers. So it's interesting to think about human systems and human geography, who will be the winners and the losers. And there are some projections that suggest urban heat is going to be a problem in the Great Lakes region in the summertime, and humidity could be a problem, storminess. So we'll still have extreme events. There's concerns about stormwater runoff and pollution of critical freshwater systems in the Midwest. On the other hand, it will still be possible to grow food, and we still will have fresh water, and we may fare a lot better than other regions. We've been talking, for example, in the city of St. Paul is going through some adaptation planning processes. We're talking about what are the climate events that are going to happen in St. Paul. And I was arguing that when we think about what might happen in St. Paul, we may actually need to say what's happening to the climate in other parts of the country or other parts of the world may have a bigger influence on what happens in St. Paul through that process of socioeconomic change and human migration. There may be an influx of people into the Great Lakes. Even if it's subtle, it could have a big demographic effect on land use and urban development.
You mean from other parts of the world?
Yeah, in other parts of the country. If you think about, for example, how, again, the amazing thing about climate change is we don't know what the future will hold, in part because we don't know how much greenhouse gas we're going to emit to the atmosphere. But some of the more business-as-usual scenarios, or if we stay on these trajectories of high emissions, agriculture in large parts of Africa is going to be extremely difficult. That could have a profound impact on agriculture and farming that we pursue in the United States,
mm-hmm.
and have a big influence on our land use.
Thank you, Jake, very much for your call. Let's go to Christoph in Madison. Hi.
Yes, I wonder why you are not talking about population control as a possible solution for some of this.
Population control is a really interesting and important consideration, certainly when we talk about climate, because people emit greenhouse gases. It's pretty straightforward to say if we had fewer people, then we may perhaps be limited, we'd have less greenhouse gas emissions. I think population issues are very important when we think about economic development. We know, for example, that education of women, economic opportunities for women is a very important process of raising living standards in parts of the world that are really going to suffer a lot of consequences of climate change. So I think that's critical. The other thing, though, about population that's a little complicated when it comes to greenhouse gas emissions is that all people are not equal. So in parts of the world, like the United States, for example, we emit an extraordinarily large amount of greenhouse gases per person, much, much larger, for example, than each person in China. So it's not so simple as to say fewer people means less emissions. Frankly, fewer Americans would mean less emissions.
Thank you, Christoph, very much for your call. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Hellman, I'm wondering, because this is going to be something that will impact all parts of the world, it almost necessitates, and I'm wondering if it will be discussed in Paris or what the plans are for looking at a worldwide examination of the migration results of climate change and the possible adaptive techniques or structures that we're going to need to build. Doesn't it need to be studied on a worldwide kind of basis?
Absolutely does. In Paris, we'll hear a conversation about individual country commitments to greenhouse gas emission reduction, or we'll hear much discussion about mitigation. We also will hear, and remember, the negotiations in Paris are formal negotiations of countries and also a whole collection of people at the same time having a global conversation about climate change. And a lot of that conversation will be about adaptation. In Copenhagen, which was one of the more recent, sort of more significant climate meetings in the same process that brings us now to Paris next month, there was a lot of talk about who will pay for adaptation and the fact that the effects of climate change will not be spread evenly around the world. And some countries will suffer consequences, or people in certain, particularly in developing countries, will not have the resources to pay for expensive adaptation. And they're also not the people who caused climate change for the most part to begin with. That'll still be part of the dialogue about who will bear the economic consequences of climate change adaptation.
Let's go to Mark in Richland Center next. Hi, Mark.
Hello. You mentioned what should we do about this? What is the response? What do we know? And there's two things that I'd like to bring up. One is we know that solar energy doesn't cause pollution, yet southern state governors and our own governor, in fact, and lots of agencies are getting in the way of renewable energy. So the absurdity of that just boggles the mind, because it's just nonsense that somebody should, on a political level, get in the way of something that's as clean as any form of renewable energy. And then with regard to the response of what should we do, there is talk about geoengineering and how we should spray metallic particles into the atmosphere, and that will reflect heat off the planet, but will also hold heat in. So the absurdity of that thought process, and there are some say that it's going on right now, is also just mind-boggling.
These are great points, Mark. I think renewable energy is incredibly important. I mean, we are going to solve this climate change crisis by changing our economies, by thinking about what it means to do well in this world and how we're going to go about our business of thriving as human beings and as a planet. And renewable energy, which is often driven by technology, is going to be a huge piece of that. We know probably it's not going to be any single kind of renewable energy, but a whole collection of wind power and solar power, maybe even some nuclear power as well, that's going to enable us to transition off of fossil fuels. But I think for solar is really, really interesting because the price of solar has come down quite a lot and is now beginning to be competitive in a traditional economic sense with traditional fossil fuels. And that probably will make that will have as big of an effect as any political discussion about solar energy will. But I think renewable energy technologies deserve the opportunity to have an even playing field against other energy sources. And I agree that it's important for our politicians to make sure that, you know, the people who want to make money off of selling solar panels have an opportunity to drive that part of the economy too. And on the subject of geoengineering, for listeners who might not know or haven't heard about geoengineering, it's a pretty interesting concept.
Yeah.
And this is the idea. It's similar to what I call adaptation, but meaningfully different. So if we're going to emit greenhouse gases, how could we sort of undo that effect? Well, adaptation is about trying to live with a warmer climate. Geoengineering is trying to reduce the warming in a different way. So one idea, for example, is injecting high in the atmosphere tiny little particles. In fact, we know there's lots of data to suggest that in theory it would work. The physics of it would work. This is exactly what happens when a major volcano goes off. The global average temperature comes down because these tiny little particles reflect incoming sunlight. Now, that would have potentially other consequences. So for example, agriculture relies on incoming sunlight.
Mm-hmm.
My particular take on geoengineering is I think we should talk about it because whenever you're confronted with a profound problem and what the climate models tell us about climate change under business as usual is really profound. So I think we do need to talk about all of the possible strategies. So I say put geoengineering on the table for conversation. However, once you talk about it for a little while, you find out that it's got some serious downsides. Not to mention the cost and the fact that it would have to be repeatedly implemented. You'd have to be constantly manipulating the global climate. Who will pay for that? Who will make sure it gets done? Could it be a political football unto itself? Again, it makes coming back and actually solving the original problem through mitigation seem a lot smarter and a heck of a lot cheaper.
Mm-hmm. Anything else, Mark?
Well, you mentioned that if you do that, then the farm industry, people need to eat, right? The particles themselves, even when a volcano erupts, eventually that stuff makes it back to Earth.
Right.
And what they're talking about spraying are particles of nanoparticles of aluminum, strontium, barium. That stuff will infect the soils. It will infect the biosphere, and it could basically destroy life.
Yeah, it's kind of also reminds you what your mom said, two wrongs don't make a right, too. You know, thinking about super technological fixes for a problem that is a technological problem, especially when we know that we have things like renewable technologies and other ways of solving this problem, it does seem like a roundabout way of addressing what has a better solution.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much for the call. Considering that we seem to be living in a time where areas are warmer, as it appears to be here in this area now, I mean, it's November, whatever, it's 50-something degrees, we haven't had hard frosts yet, do we have enough information looking at what has happened already with climate change, Professor Hellman, to indicate that there are certain kinds of crops that will no longer thrive here and they need to be moved farther north, or certain crops farther south that need to be moved to this climate? Is all of that happening now or not?
Well, there's a lot of talk and research going into crop varietals and breeding crops, especially in developing countries that would be, for example, more drought tolerant. And there is concern about how, for example, changing temperatures and precipitation will affect yields. So less so, you know, it's not so much will we need to plant something other than corn, but how will we go about, for example, how will we go about doing that corn production so that it maintains the yields that we're accustomed to? And one of the major concerns, for example, is the amount and timing of rainfall. In the Midwest, we rely a great deal on there not being too much rain when we, in the early part of the year, when we're trying to plow our fields, and but we want enough rain when the crop is actually growing. So changing when rain falls could actually have an influence on crop production. And we may very well need to rely on greater irrigation when we experience drought periods. So when we say in the future we imagine a climate that's more extreme, that means periods of heavy rain, maybe changing distribution of the year of when that rain comes, maybe we know making the growing season longer, but it also means we'll go through longer periods of extreme drought as well. And so this will require infrastructure, it will require investments and changing the way we go about doing some of our basic farming practices.
This message, why do we continue to subsidize coal and gas industries when we know this information, even as the president agrees with man-made global warming?
Well, it's, we have an economy, we are a ship that is slow to steer, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose a rapid uptake of alternative technologies, it certainly is a difficult thing to do. And there's lots of concern about economic development and economic opportunity around the world that we don't want to disrupt too readily. I do think that alternative technologies are coming online fast, and I think, this is my particular take, and if you look at some of the commitments that countries have made to the Paris meetings, for example, about what greenhouse gas emission reductions they're going to do, you can see that the economy will transition to alternative energy sources. But what we have to decide for ourselves and the priorities that we need to set is how quickly will that transition happen? Because how quickly it happens will have a direct influence on how much warmer the world will be. And if we want lesser climate change, we need to accelerate that transition, even if it is ultimately inevitable.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Philip in Milwaukee. Hi, Philip.
Hi. I'm certainly glad you have this person on your program. I got in late, so I'm not sure if she's going to Paris. I sincerely hope she does. I believe two major things must happen in order for us to have a sustainable planet for human life. I think we have to change the definition of profit, and I think we have to move to amend or its equivalent, because corporations should not have the same rights as we the people, because they trump us all the time.
Yes, Philip, I think a lot of people have talked about what is it. We certainly want a world in which people have an opportunity to flourish. In fact, one of the major challenges of climate change is that it undermines the ability of many people around the world to flourish. And it may make it'll change the way we'll need to do traditional economic development, because we can't do economic development that's fossil fuel intensive if we want to avoid catastrophic climate change. But at the same time, those people, they deserve the opportunity to flourish as well. However, if we have an economic system that is only values growth and that growth is powered by fossil fuels, we know that is not sustainable. So we need to redefine both our energy usage, but also what it is that what constitutes quality of life. What are these economies for? What is it that we're trying to achieve? I think many economists, many ethicists, many people who focus on global economic development would agree that that's true. Certainly those of us in the sort of climate science community recognize that there has to be an alternate economic model if we're going to have a sustainable planet. Now, corporations as having different kinds of rights or rights equivalent to individual people, that certainly affects the way that democracy and decision-making happens. You happen to be talking to a scientist on the phone or on this radio program today. So how best to pursue democracy is not exactly my area of specialty, but collective decision-making is crucial to how we're going to address this problem. Now, corporations do have some really interesting roles potentially to play in how we're going to do this economic transition. We are going to Paris, the University of Minnesota, and this country's leading universities are sending delegations to participate in the activities that are happening in Paris. I'll be there. I'm really looking forward to it. When you look at the commitments that individual countries are bringing to Paris, and we already know what they are, that in Paris we'll just be sort of finalizing the deal. Those commitments really do not get us that far. They do not reduce greenhouse gas emissions by very much, very fast. Some of the numbers that came out of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, which is what the Paris meetings are all about, the organization that hosts the global conversation on climate change and greenhouse gas mitigation, they had a report last month suggested that these things that are called intended nationally determined contributions, or INDCs. This is each country's voluntary commitment that is put forward for Paris. That those will reduce per capita emissions by something like 8% by 2025 and 9% by 2030. That's not very much if you think about what that trajectory needs to be to avoid, for example, 2 degrees C of warming. So what will need to happen is those will need to ratchet up. Those INDCs, those individual commitments, are going to need to get higher and higher and higher and higher. And companies have a great role to play in inspiring and leading and demonstrating how they are going to participate. In fact, some companies are doing this already, getting on board and saying, this is what we're going to do in our business to make a difference to greenhouse gas emissions. And those INDCs are going to need that corporate participation.
Hmm. Thank you, Philip, very much for your call. We'll take more phone calls in just one moment. We're talking about a new era of migration this hour of the program, when climate changes, organisms move. And our guest has co-authored a paper in The Conversation. We are entering a new migration of era of migration, and it's not just for people. She reminds us, last ice age, world was about 10 degrees Fahrenheit colder, and forests dominated Death Valley in California. It's now a hot desert. What happened to the trees? They moved. There used to be alligators living at the poles. As dramatic as past episodes of climate change have been, she writes, they've generally played out over very long time periods, so the average rates of migration were fairly slow. But the situation today is extremely different. The rate of change in the next century projected to be at least 10 times the rate observed at the end of the last ice age. So what does all of that mean? What should we do about it? That's what we're talking about this hour, and welcoming your phone calls. Our guest is Professor Jessica Hellman, Director of the Institute on the Environment at the University of Minnesota. Her research focuses on global change ecology and climate adaptation. And we'll take more phone calls momentarily. 800-486-8655 is the number. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter as well. At K. Dunn Show, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go back to phone calls. Matthew in Stevens Point, hi.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I recently moved from the Pacific Northwest, where I was studying agriculture, and a professor of mine had mentioned with other interested students that want to farm themselves, if you want a reliable source of water, move near the Canadian Rockies or waterways of, in that that mountain range was, in the projections that he had read, not likely to be as affected with snowpack, that it was going to remain pretty steady with snowpack. And I'm just wondering, as that is an example, is there some sort of database that people can look at in terms of, like, plugging in a zip code or looking specifically at wherever they might be interested in living or where they are now to see, you know, 5, 10, maybe 20 years down the road, what would change, if anything?
Well, that's a great question, Matthew. So I'm trying to think where would be a best place to send people. There are a variety. Of course, you can go get climate data from the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. And there are, if you look, for example, at the assessment reports that come from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is a scientific group that is part of the UNFCCC, they have things, for example, a great resource is the Summary for Policymakers. They also have PowerPoint slides that show projections for the globe where you could look and see for individual pixels, for example, around Colorado. I mean, one challenge, there's so much interesting science to be done on climate change. It's interesting. On the one hand, there's so much that we know and understand and agree upon about the basic functioning of global climate, but it's really, really hard and still largely unknown what the very local consequences of climate change will be. So, for example, if you went there to the IPCC and looked at the climate projections and zoomed in, if you will, to that part of the United States, you'll see that one square is still relatively large. And what happens within that one square will matter to the people who live in that square. That's something we call downscaling. And knowing how climate change will play out very locally is sort of a remaining frontier in climate science. But that's one place that I would send you to look would be to the IPCC's fifth assessment report.
Okay, great. Thank you again.
Thanks, Matthew, so much for the call. Wayne in Holman is next. Hi, Wayne.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
I haven't talked to you for a while.
Thanks for calling, Wayne.
Yeah, you have a very interesting guest, and I certainly respect her intellect. We farmed for 23 years, and I have just a couple questions, and I'm interested in your response. As a farmer, here's what I need to keep my rigs in the fields, my tractors, and my equipment. I need oil, grease, diesel fuel, unleaded gas, and hydraulic fluid.
Right, and you're saying these are all fossil fuels, and they're part of what it means to grow food, that in especially in this part of the world, and that's an important part of feeding ourselves. And you're absolutely right. It's also a part of agriculture's contribution, and you know, just like fossil fuel use in every other sector of the economy, part of the contribution to greenhouse gases. I don't think, this is my personal opinion, you know, these are difficult challenges, and it's not so simple as to say we stop doing one thing and start doing something else, or one industry is to blame and another industry is the salvation. I don't think that's true at all. I think feeding the world, and especially in this part of the world, we play an enormously important role in agricultural, you know, feeding the entire globe. And we're going to need tractors that run on diesel fuel for quite some time. But at the same time, I think it's appropriate to imagine how we can do that more efficiently, more effectively. What are other cropping techniques or technologies, ways in which we can reduce greenhouse gas emissions, even from agricultural production?
Thank you.
Thanks, Wayne, for the call. Chad in Green Bay. Hi, Chad.
Hi there.
Hi.
Mike? Comment is basically, you know, getting away from fossil fuels. You want to, you know, theoretically do like solar panels and that sort of good stuff. But what about the amount of resources that it costs to produce a solar panel? I mean, because we've done studies in my college that said, you know, it's not really worth it on the grand scheme of things because you're using all these resources to, you know, produce maybe a gigawatt over its lifetime when, you know, you spent a gigawatt and a half to produce this panel.
Right.
You know, it's like, it sounds great to make that easy transition, but a lot of times, you know, pound for pound, oil ends up being the better producer.
Well, I would encourage, this is a good point, Chad, what you need to do when you're evaluating different energy technologies is to think about how much does each unit of energy produce in terms of greenhouse gases? Also, how much work can it get done? This is the amazing thing about fossil fuels, is they contain a lot of energy per unit. They get a lot of work done. They move things. They produce a lot of electricity per unit. But when you're producing, for example, something like a solar panel, it doesn't just produce one unit of energy. It does it over some period of time. So you have to compare that fossil fuel, for example, that gets combusted and is used up and is not available for future production against a technology that can generate activity, generate energy over some period of time. And that is the important comparison. Some cases, for example, depending on climate or where you might put the solar panel, it may be that the fossil fuel works out in terms of how much energy can be produced. But solar panels are becoming better and better. They have better lifespan, and so they work in a wider range of climates than in the past. So that's making solar energy more competitive. Another thing you'll hear people say about solar power not being competitive with fossil fuels has to do with price. And that is more tricky, and we shouldn't fall into the trap of thinking that fossil fuels are better because they're cheaper. Because what greenhouse gas emissions are showing us is that we're not paying the full price of fossil fuels. There's the side effect, or what economists call an externality, that is not reflected in the price that we pay for gasoline. And we have to deal with that problem. We have to pay for that problem in some other way. For example, we'll have to pay for adaptation to adjust to climate change. That's not reflected in the price of oil. So it seems like a solar panel is more expensive, perhaps, and that's because there's something that's not captured in the price of oil that makes it seem cheaper.
I want to talk about one of the things that we haven't mentioned that was in the article that you wrote, that we need to identify regions with the fastest climatic shifts where we expect the greatest migration, and then plan parks and preserves to serve as recipients for migrating species and preserving the corridors that allow plant and animals to move through heavily fragmented urban and agricultural landscapes. Isn't that interesting? Are we doing that?
We are. So ecologists, in fact, this is one of the things that inspired my colleague and I to write this article, watching the human migration in Europe, out of the Middle East, and again, the situation is politically complicated, but humans being organisms and being inclined to move when conditions become unfavorable, or at least that's something that we share in our sort of evolutionary history. We said, well, again, I mentioned this previously, if you thought about this like an ecologist, you'd expect migration to be one of the main ways in which organisms would respond, perhaps including people. And then we thought about this a little bit more, and we said, actually, if you look at ecology, or say conservation biology, you'll see, in natural resource management, you'll see agencies, scientists getting together to start talking about planning for this adaptation, thinking about where should parks be placed, which species are most vulnerable, and even thinking about should we play a role, for example, in helping things move under climate change. And we thought it would be provocative to say that that exact same kind of planning process should be going on with respect to people. That why does it feel surprising to us when there are flows of migrants, and under climate change we may expect even more people on the move, escaping conditions that are politically dangerous and unsuitable climatically. We should anticipate, what are the regions that are most vulnerable? Where are places that are most resistant to climate change? And start imagining how we might manage this process of chaos and adjustment a little bit more intelligently than you see going down at the moment around the world. And so ecologists, now of course we're not brilliant at examples of that, but you certainly hear at conferences like for the one I'm attending right now here in Montreal, where we're discussing insect conservation, there are people here thinking about what are the management techniques and what role can we play in facilitating this process of adjustment under climate change. So it's provocative, I think, to ask ourselves, what is the human analog of that socio and politically? And are we getting ready for it? Are we taking the right steps to be prepared?
Right. Thank you so much, Chad, for your call. I'm sorry we didn't get to everybody today, but we'll be on this subject again. Jessica Hellman, thank you so much for being our guest. Most informative.
Thank you for having me.
Professor Jessica Hellman, Professor of Ecology, Evolution, and Behavior at the University of Minnesota and Director of the Institute on the Environment. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour and to K.P. as well for on-air production. Tomorrow at this time, celebrating and honoring veterans, a veteran pilot of World War II, a Korean troop leader will be with us, and a Gulf War veteran. So they'll talk about their wars and their service, and that will be tomorrow at this hour. Thanks for listening.